Welcome to Art If, the podcast about art, life, and everything in between. Welcome back to episode 12 of the Art If podcast. I'm Hattie.
And I'm Yossi. In this week's gallery, we talk about art and vulnerability, how art heightens the experience of vulnerability, and how the art itself can be vulnerable.
And then we interview Samantha Behrman about how she mixes the political and the personal in her stand-up comedy.
And as always, we end with a provocation that asks you to make the change you want to see in the world. And don't be afraid of asking for help in that.
If you love this podcast, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to get the latest episodes and minisodes. So, art and vulnerability.
Yes, which we were thinking of because comedians often use personal anecdotes to liven up their sets and have to be willing to share some of the not so nice things about their life for comedic effect, right?
Yeah.
So, where did you go?
Well, I thought community was hard, but this was way harder for me to come up with anything. Because I kept sort of just running across things that I felt like were just sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because I think a lot of times with vulnerability, we talk about emotions.
Right. It's like maudlin. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I ran across all of this, like, sad stuff and...
Yeah, and I was trying to stay away from, like... I mean, we both do theater, so this idea of, like, emotional vulnerability. Because actors, right? You're like, oh, they were so vulnerable, they were so open. And I'm like, no, I don't want to talk about that, right? Like, I don't want to talk about... Because that felt like the obvious choice.
Yeah. But the other, I think, important characteristics of vulnerability are uncertainty and risk.
Okay. All right.
And I stole those because when I Googled vulnerability, Brené Brown is all over the fucking internet.
Yep.
And that's her definition.
Yep. That is what comes up when you Google vulnerability is Brené Brown. Yeah. Which is great.
Yeah. So I was talking with Joel about this, and we were talking about vulnerability in a number of different ways.
Okay.
And so one of the things he suggested was... Well, first of all, I started thinking about, well, what are other ways we use the word vulnerable besides just emotional? And so at first I was like, oh, vulnerable populations. So like, what if I did art by refugees or art by prisoners? And then Joel said something about, well, what about works of art that are themselves vulnerable?
Like, no, that's come on. Fragile? That's what I'm doing.
Okay, well, I'm not doing that.
Okay, good. Because my whole thing was like, I'd put a good twist on it because the art itself is vulnerable.
Awesome. But with things like that could break, it made me think of things that were dangerous or risky. And so I was thinking about body manipulation, but I think this was Joel's suggestion, knife throwing.
Oh, okay. So I think of like old timey carnivals, like some guy in a top hat being like, I'm missing a finger.
Yes.
Those are mixed images. I admittedly, I don't think I have a clear image in my head now that I'm telling you what it is.
Well, so broadly speaking, to separate it from knife throwing as a sport, which would be like axe throwing or archery, those kinds of like target arts. Knife throwing as a performance art is called the impalement arts.
Okay.
And the goal is to not impale anyone.
Right. Hopefully. Unless it's that kind of show. I mean, unless you're Roman.
Right. I'm not doing Romans.
Okay.
We're going a little more contemporary than that. We are going sort of circusy.
Yay.
But impalement arts as a thing in and of themselves, that term was first coined in 1871. And so this idea of the impalement arts really gained popularity through the circus in the 19th century, early 20th century, and also through Wild West shows like Wild Bill Hickok and Buffalo Bill and stuff like that. So there are four categories of the impalement arts: knife throwing, archery, bull whipping, and sharpshooting.
Okay. So not sword swallowing.
No. These are all where the sharp object would be thrown at a person.
Okay.
Towards a person, not at a person.
Right.
The idea is not, again, the idea is not to impale them.
We're not talking about executions here that are put right on for spectacle. This is a spectacle without death involved.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. If it goes well.
So I focused mostly on knife throwing. And so the three most famous tricks are the profile, where the usually the knife thrower is a male and the target girl is what the person at the other end is called. And she stands against throwing boards and she stands in profile and she arches her back. So she's leaning backwards and the knife thrower throws a series of knives that form a line that follow the arc of her body. So one hits at her belly button, one hits at her chest, one hits at her throat, and then one hits right above her face. Okay,
so it creates like an arc.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so not only does the knife thrower have to not hit her, but she has to not move, and she has to hold that position as she's being threatened by each of these knife throws.
Okay.
And then the second most famous trick is the headstand, where the target girl is in a headstand and her legs are spread and he throws knives at her ankles.
That's not suggestive at all.
At her knees. Right.
And that knife stands in for?
A
knife.
A knife. Yeah, just a knife.
It's like the dagger, let's see, in Commedia dell'arte, right? Oh. Pantalone's dagger rises and falls depending on who he's on stage with.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the Wheel of Death. So
okay, that one is like the one I feel like you see a lot represented. Okay.
So moving targets in terms of all sorts of target arts and sports really developed in the 1930s. And the Wheel of Death emerged in 1938 by a German couple of knife throwers called the Gibsons.
Okay.
But yes, this is the target board is a big circle and the target girl is typically pinned. I don't know if pinned is the right word. Strapped to the target board.
I was going to say shackled, but that may be a little too dark.
In a spread eagle position, and then they spin the wheel, and as it's spinning, the knife thrower has to throw rapid, consistent, carefully timed throws to hit the target board without hitting the person that is on the target board. Some cool things about this are that it's almost never a trick. It's always like real knives. Right? I think there's been a lot of mythology that the knives were actually on the back side of the target board and would pop out.
Oh, I see.
Through the target board.
But then where is the thrown knife? It just disappears?
Magic.
Okay.
Right? Sleight of hand. But that's not how it works. It is almost always real and has, in fact, ended in some catastrophes. One that particularly interesting in 2003... Yana Radianova was injured on television by her knife thrower, Jade Hansen. He hit her in the head, and then she married him a year later. So, no trust lost there.
Were they dating before? Or unclear. Like, the hit to the head changed everything.
Changed everything. I don't know. I didn't see that.
This takes up the pickup artist strategies to the extreme, I guess. Like, throw a knife at them, and then they'll marry you.
Right.
Okay. Don't do that.
So, in thinking about this, I was like, well, where's the room for creativity? Where's the room for innovation? Because this is really about precision. It's about physics, and it's about precision.
Right.
But it necessitated the development of a very particular kind of throwing knife.
Okay. There are special knives that are meant to be thrown?
Yes.
Oh,
they're different from a typical knife because they don't have any scales on the handle. So it's just a single piece of steel with nothing else attached and no split. And that helps the balance.
Okay.
I know that the handles are called scales because I've been watching this show on the History Channel called Forged in Fire, which is basically Project Runway, but for knife making.
Oh, okay. Cool.
It's super fascinating.
Are you a knife person?
No. I'm an art person. Okay. And I was like, oh, they're making things.
Okay. Because I don't know. Knives are, they've kind of Anyway.
Actually,
there's some weird association with knives.
My stepbrother used, I don't know if he still does, but collected knives. And when I was on study abroad in like 2005 in some country, I found this really adorable, like miniature sword. It was like 9 inches long. And like the little sword handle was like a half an inch wide. And I was so excited about it. And I brought it back. And I was like, look at this super cool miniature sword I got you. And he was like, Hattie, that is a letter opener. So I know nothing about knives.
That's amazing. What's the appeal of knives, do you think? You think it's like one of the first tools that humans created? So there's this sort of appreciation for it? Or
well, I think that there's a lot of artistry in the development of the steel from the iron and the way you mold it and the way you harden it and the different kinds of, so once it's heated to, it has to be heated to a certain temperature and then you quench it to cool it, and you can quench it in either oil or water. But if the temperature is wrong of the metal before you quench it or of the liquid that you're quenching it in, that it can crack. But that process hardens the steel so that when you use it, the steel edge doesn't roll or chip or crack. And so if that process isn't done properly, then it's not useful.
Oh, interesting.
And then the different shapes of the blades also lend themselves to cutting different kinds of materials and doing different kinds of cuts or different kinds of murders.
Okay. Or different kinds of circus tricks.
So these throwing knives don't have handles. It also necessitated different kinds of grips because you have to be able to spin the blade a certain number of times. And so whether you hold it at the handle or hold it at the blade, if you need it to, if you're a certain distance, it's going to spin a certain number of times depending on how far away you are. And so if you need it to spin a half a turn versus a full turn or 1.5 turns, you have to hold it either at the blade or the handle in order to make that happen.
Okay.
And so you have to be very careful about how you control the spin. And then I think one of the cool things about the artistry of the impalement arts is they're controlling the spin such that they can make it look like the blade is entering the throwing board closer to the target girl than it actually is. So if they...
Why?
If they adjust...
Or how? How does the spin affect that?
Depending... If you push the spin farther, then the blade enters the board at an angle.
Oh, I see.
And so you can adjust it so that if you angle it so that the handle is toward the target girl, that it actually enters the board farther away from her body, but it looks closer.
I see. Okay.
So there's a little bit of artistry there.
Have you ever seen this done?
I watched some YouTube videos, but I don't think I've ever seen it done live.
I feel like I have. I don't know if, like, maybe... So in Tucson, there's this theme park called Old Tucson Studios that used to be, like, where a lot of Westerns were filmed and still are to some extent, but a lot of the, like, big Westerns in the 50s and 60s were filmed in Tucson, and they have all these sorts of shows, like stunt shows and things. So
cool.
Maybe there, also maybe at the Coney Island Freak Show.
Oh, probably.
I know I saw a sword swallower there, so they may have done that too. I know I have seen it at some point, but I can't.
Cool.
But mine was more of the profile.
Yeah.
But it was one where, like, they stand not in profile, they stand like against the board and they sort of make the shape this way.
Yeah,
like
I think that's when that one's like the William Tell.
Yes.
Because
yes,
of the apple on the head.
Apple and the arrow. Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of other tricks, but those three are just the like most famous ones, I guess, or like the standards.
Cool.
So one of the things that makes this appealing is it depends a lot on making us feel vulnerable as we watch it as well. So the target girl, of course, is vulnerable. Because she could die.
Or get married. She could die or get hit in the head and get married.
Well played. Yeah. So the idea is to try and make the audience members feel this risk, this uncertainty, and some sense of emotion. And one of the important factors to most of these performances is the attractiveness of the target girl.
That makes sense.
So a lot of times in these performances, the target girl is overtly sexualized, etc.
And how is this different from other performances?
Well, it's not. But the way it operates, maybe.
Okay.
Right? I think that there's two levels here. One, I think maybe we don't like to see pretty things get damaged.
Yeah.
But also, any sort of sexual arousal is going to heighten that experience. And so there is this play at sadomasochism that kind of goes into it. And that the dangerous part of sexuality and sexual acts, I think, is a prominent part of this. The exception, hopefully, to that is, this one probably should just never have happened. I ran across a woman, Luella Gallagher, in the 1950s, who used her 5-year-old and 2.5-year-old as target girls.
That's so sad.
So there's a video of this, because my first reaction was like, what is going through someone's head that wants to put their children in this vulnerable position?
This is like a modern day Circus Medea.
Yes, she did not kill them, though.
Okay, good. But that makes me think of, like, you know, you were saying a part of the key to this is the target girl whose arch can't move, right?
Right.
And like, how can you trust a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old not to move? I mean, all my friends are complaining their kids won't even wear a mask
right.
for like a minute. Like,
exactly.
So you watched the video and?
I watched the video. She has them stand with their arms pressed up against their chest, kind of like tied together in a knot. They're smiling. The other thing is, though, she's literally only like 6 feet away. And she's okay. throwing the knives, and there's a substantial amount of space between where they land and the bodies of the little girls. So I feel like she's close enough. There's no way she misses unless the girls, like, really move.
Yeah, okay.
But still, it's very gimmicky, and I'm sure it attracted, like, some pretty intense crowds and created a lot of tension in the audience.
Yeah. Well, and for that sure. it is heightening, right? This sort of sense of vulnerability.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, we've already sort of ruined my spin, the reveal of my spin on this.
The breakable?
Well, not breakable. So I actually went with, like, art that was, like, intended to be vulnerable as a part of the art itself. So, you know, one of the biggest examples that we think of recently is like that Banksy painting that was sold at auction and then immediately was put through a shredder. Did you see that?
Oh, no.
And so, like, the intent was to sort of make a comment about the art market and shred the painting right nice. After it was purchased for some sort of record number of millions. And it was partially shredded.
And the purchaser didn't know that was going to happen, right?
No, no.
Ah!
Right. So, but that's a part of the art, right? And then the other one I was thinking of recently is I went to this exhibit in Kuwait at the Scientific Center that was about environmental issues and sort of pollution and that sort of thing. And one of the pieces was called Candy Party. And it was this hanging installation of, like, candies in, like, blister packs, you know, like medicine, you pop the blister.
Oh, okay.
So they were like candy. And the whole point is, like, you could choose to have a candy or you could choose to create plastic waste, right? So the idea is, like, and then the exhibit changed throughout the piece. So, like, if you saw it later on, there would be more just waste versus candy, depending on how many people chose to eat or not.
Oh, cool.
And so it is cool, but so the main artist I'm talking about is Felix Gonzalez Torres, who this is a lot of his work actually is meant to change throughout their exhibition.
Oh.
And I didn't realize, because I've seen one of his pieces. I saw actually quite a few of his pieces. It was some sort of exhibit of his, but I did not see his candy pieces, which is what he's famous for. So now I'm like, oh, they were totally ripping that off in Kuwait. Whoever did that one.
Oh,
was
funny.
Somewhat of a ripoff. I mean, his don't have the environmental sort of effect, but let me go back. A lot of his pieces are meant to showcase, to be metaphors for, like, dying or disappearing or wasting away. And a part of this is he was a gay artist who ended up dying of AIDS and was working a lot during the AIDS epidemic. So he was trying to find ways in which you could make seen the invisible or the vulnerable or the way that the virus was sort of taking over slowly. And
is audience participation critical to most of his projects?
Yes, exactly. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, the ones I'm thinking about in terms of the pieces themselves relying on vulnerability and sort of change and destruction to make their point. Mm. So his candy exhibits are just that. They're a big pile of candy, and the museum public is invited to take a piece. And so if you see that exhibit day one, you're going to see a pile of candy. And if you see it day seven, you may see just a handful of candies on the ground. So depending on like when you encounter it, it's going to be different. It's shifting.
Cool.
The one I saw was they were like stacks of papers. They mm-hmm. looked like towers, and you could take one and take it home. So not only do you get like a piece of the art, mm-hmm. which was facts from his like personal life.
Oh.
But all the towers started the same size, but depending on where people took from them, they sort of ended up being different sizes and shapes, and, you know, they ended up telling a different story. And then there is this sense like, oh, it's going to disappear. Do I want to be responsible for making this art disappear? Is that the part of the process? It kind of puts you in a bit of an ethical dilemma. Another piece that, oh, and the reason I'm not naming any of them is because they're all called Untitled. So, I mean, the majority of them are Untitled. But another one is a pair of clocks. And I saw this one too. And they're called Perfect Lovers. So they start in sync, but the idea is that one of them will run out of battery before the other. And so this idea of like a disconnect and the separation and time and...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there's a way in which I would say vulnerability of the art itself is necessary for the message.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he's Cuban American. He passed away in 1996 at age 38. So unfortunately, we don't get a ton of his work, but much of it is very much exploring these themes of taking away, of gradual decline.
Mm-hmm.
And that's contingent upon the art itself sort of being open to uncertainty. And mm-hmm. let's use that same uncertainty, risk, change, and intimacy also between the person who takes the piece of candy or the piece of paper that has his personal details on it and the artist himself.
That's so interesting. And there's also a challenge wrapped up in a lot of that when you make yourself vulnerable, right, there is someone on the other end who has some responsibility in that to either continue that damage or to create a space where your vulnerability doesn't have to result in damage.
Right. But it's hard to know as someone who's partaking in the art, like the goal is for these things to change in some way, right? Because that's how the message, so do I participate or not? And I think that you see some of this in performance art too, when there's like a vulnerability, or even in comedy or in live performance where someone's making themselves vulnerable and there's an exchange happening in the moment that creates these forms of intimacy maybe, or sort of understanding, whether it's through laughter or tears or some other connection. But it feels a little different when it's out of time, right? So this piece was made a long time ago. Now they're shown right after his death.
Mm.
And we know the intent of some of these. And they say it's an invitation, like, please take one. So it's not like choose whether or not to take one. It's like, please take one.
Oh, and so
it's an invitation, but it also feels, I can't explain, the intimacy doesn't have the same feeling because you're interacting. There's like an object as proxy, a vulnerable object as proxy between human and human interaction. I don't know. It's interesting when you think about this ways in which, and I was trying to think if there are other examples of art where the object itself is necessarily vulnerable, but there's some nature art that I came across too, like people who do art with ice and snow that only remains until like the next snowfall, or like art along coasts that then disappears slowly as the ocean overtakes it.
Cool.
So yeah, it's just interesting. I couldn't think of any. Can you think of any other like art that intentionally disappears that's not of the body? And if you can't, that's fine. I mean, I've been thinking, I've been racking my brain for like a week. And
I watched several years ago, I was tasked to do some sort of weird performance project. And somehow I ended up in this super weird YouTube rabbit hole.
And so it goes.
Watching fruit decay.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so there was time-lapse videos of decaying fruit.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was. They were fascinating and really cool. engrossing.
Yeah, I was going to say, nice pun. All right. Well, that's my take on art and vulnerability.
Cool.
I didn't take the candy, if you were wondering, in Kuwait, but I did take the piece of paper.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, it made me think of, I used to go, when I lived in Phoenix, I went almost every single week to this open mic poetry event. And I'm not a poet. I just went to watch. But after like 6 months of going every single week, I started to feel like I was a voyeur and that I was there sort of like receiving and taking. And so I started writing and I started performing with them as sort of like solidarity, I guess.
Yeah. Because otherwise it feels like the vulnerability is one way.
Reciprocity.
Yeah.
And it felt like, it felt like taking.
So that's interesting. So like a vulnerability needs to be an exchange of some sort then.
Yeah. Hmm.
That's interesting. All right.
Yeah. Art and vulnerability. Cool.
Hi, everyone. We are so excited to talk to Samantha today.
Great. My name is Samantha Behrman, but my stage name is Sam Bear, and I'm a comedian and a producer. Along with being a mental health professional, I have a master's in public health. Always got to put that out there. The most expensive piece of paper I own. yep. And what I do is I honestly think what I do is I put a stage together of incredible people. That's what I strive to do the most. I love my shows to be inclusive and representative. And those words to me are honestly kind of buzzwords, because it's not like I build out my set like, okay, have I filled all my affirmative action quotas as a woman of color who's Jewish? No, I just don't. I don't know. I don't like to see shows that I always see where it's like four white dudes and like one token person. Although I do use that to my benefit when booking shows for myself.
Are you the token?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I'll send them their own flyers and say, hey, I've noticed like a lot of, you know, like white dudes, and you don't have any person of color or women. Don't worry. Just hire me. Double down your quota. With me, it's 2-for-1. And then I always end those emails with like a hashtag affirmative action in case they like didn't understand what I was saying. I'm not gonna lie. Nine out of ten.
It's hard to explain that sometimes to white dudes, huh?
Dude, let me tell you, 9 out of 10, that white guilt is strong. And I get that book.
Oh, that's amazing. Can you tell us a little bit about your show?
Yeah.
What you do?
So it's called Bear Cave Comedy, and it was born out of the idea that I really wanted a space. And I was like, oh, I'll just wait until I buy one. And I thought, that's nonsense. Poppycock. So I put it out into the universe. And not just that, I talked with a lot of different business owners about utilizing their space and bringing a comedy show there. And every show that I've produced so far has been not only sold out, but we've had to turn upwards of 20 or 30 people away at the door. So
that's awesome.
So that's a bit about my show. And like I said, I try and include a range of genders, sizes, ages, location, socioeconomic status. And I really think that's one of the driving forces behind its success, is that I give people a show of variety versus, I'm not saying, listen, I don't have any problem with white male comics. I mean, I've got problems with white male comics, but like in general, I've booked them. But to have five people from that background, I think there's a stifled range of diversity. And
right. Well, it just doesn't represent the world around us.
No.
Like, sure. It's just that's what the dominant voices have been for a long time, but it's just not representative of the world we live in. And so.
And part of what makes comedy great is the surprise factor. If you've heard a joke before, right? And so if you're dealing in the same kind of people, you're dealing in the same kind of jokes over and over, and that's tired.
Yeah. Yeah. No yawning at my shows. I kick you out.
Perfect.
Awesome.
So what do you look for when you're booking a comic? Like, what makes a good comic for you?
They make me laugh. I'm looking for confidence above all else. The clip they send me, it does need to be good. You know, it's great when the audience is laughing in the clip, but I've also performed a great set to an audience that doesn't know their job is to laugh. Yes, audience has a job. Don't show up to a comedy show with this mentality, like, make me laugh. That's the same as going to a hypnotist and being like, you can't hypnotize me. Like, just go have a good time. Go in that attitude and like you'll everything will go better. I also, if their material is unique, it also doesn't have to make me uproarious laughter. I am thinking about the variety of comic talent. Like, different audience members are attracted to different things. And I try really hard to think, okay, maybe they're not perfect for me personally. But how many people would vibe with that? And so far, all of my comics make me laugh a lot. So I luck out a lot with that.
What do you think makes you a good comic? Like, I think comedy is so hard to sort of define because it is so personal. So what do you think your strengths as a comic are?
I'm very witty. I think very quickly on my feet. I am really good at observing people's expressions and the room. I read the room, I think, very well. And I'm not afraid to interact with the audience. It's called riffing. A lot of comics are fearful of it because it's more of a risk than when you're saying your own material, because there could be a Janet who like doesn't want to talk to you and you've like picked the wrong person and they're just like, you know, like, I didn't come here to participate. Or you could get someone on the opposite end who like is so excited and they just keep talking and you're like, oh no.
Yeah, I just watched a clip of one of your shows where somebody keeps talking and you're like, it's my turn. Yeah. I really like that.
Thank you.
But luckily, I think riffing is when I see a good comedian like riff, that's when I'm like, oh wow, that person is skilled, right? Because not to say that people who perform sort of scripted things or their own material, it's just a different skill. So it I'm is. Really impressed by riffing.
Yeah. It's a different set of intelligence.
It's very different skills. And then even within comedy, there's different subsects of skills like character work, acting out, storytelling, long form, list form. And so many. I think what makes me a good comic is I know what I'm saying is funny. And I believe in every joke that I say. Hmm. And that doesn't mean that they all, I mean, 90%, I'm not gonna lie, 90% of mine are out of the park. But you gotta put your new material out there and see like what tweaks need to be made. And sometimes it's the difference of two words. And truly that can change it from like, huh, that's funny, to a room full of people just laughing.
Wow.
There's something about stand-up. So our theme this week, we decided at the very last minute, is art and vulnerability. Yeah. And you know, like when I create like a theater show, or if I'm doing a painting or something, like, yeah, there's vulnerability in that, but there's also so much distance between me and the piece.
Yeah.
And so as a comic, it's not only your words, but it's you up there. And there's this immediacy to it. Do you rely on vulnerability? How does that play into your work?
Yeah, 100%. The first time I had a show, I was obviously very nervous, and it was really vulnerable because I kept thinking, like, I think this is funny. I know this is funny. And I wrote it down. Like, I crafted every joke. I know exactly I'm going from here to there. And that's the other thing. When you watch a show and you're like, wow, it looks like they're just coming off the top of their head. Yeah, that's hours and hours, days and days of work to make it look like we're just like, oh, well, let me just tell you this new thought. It's not a new thought. We know what we were going to say. There was a part of me that's like, it's sad, but I was like, I hope they like it. And it wasn't like, I hope they like me. I'm very likable. Mm. And clearly I have the confidence to back that up. I hope they like the material. You know, it's very vulnerable because you believe in it and you're kind of at the fault of the audience. Do they believe in it too? So yeah, very vulnerable.
Do you find any, let me see what I'm trying to ask. Do you find that if you tell more about yourself, you bring the audience more in? Like if you're sort of more open about who you really are, sort of your authenticity, or, I mean, like, how do you balance that and still maintain like boundaries that allow you to perform and not just be like a, you know, goo on stage?
Yeah. Honestly, I think stage presence and confidence can make up for sharing so much about yourself. And what I tell people who know me and then see me on stage, it's an exaggerated version of myself. Mm-hmm. Like I know different people and you know, it's choices. Maybe they go into a full different character. I know a lot of comics who are like off stage. They're like, don't talk to me. I'm very introverted. And that's not me, but I have realized over the several years that my stage presence is a lot. It's like me on 10 or 100. It's just a lot more energy. I think a solid comic should be able to connect with the audience regardless of how much personal information they're sharing. And then people who are involved in the personal stories, they're like, it didn't exactly go that way. I'm like, I have the microphone. Like, I got to change the story, man. Like,
that's how that you're goes. Like, artistic license.
This isn't a testimonial. Yeah. This is a comedy show.
That's the other thing. People will take, like, who maybe know bits and pieces, like, if they know you personally, they're like, well, that's not what happened. I'm like, I got to change it. That's one of the best things about being a comic. It's like, yeah, well, sounded funnier this way. And like, it should have gone that way. So there we go.
Yeah. Reality isn't always the most funny thing.
No.
Right? Write your own story.
Exactly. Yeah.
So your work is like very outspokenly political, which is why I love it. How has that affected the reception of it? Like both good and bad?
Yeah, it's, you got to be willing to take something politically being said and it not landing well. And honestly, you have to be able to have like a good recovery from that. Sometimes I'll address it like, oh, okay, this is interesting. Like I did a show in Arizona. I did a tour through there and race was not a topic they wanted to talk about. And I talked about it 3 times and to their credit, they didn't say anything, but they didn't say anything. Like as a comic, you want some reaction. Mm. I was like, oh, okay. And so I talked about it. I said, I didn't realize that Arizona as a state, you collectively have agreed. No, we refuse to acknowledge race. I'm like, I mean, that's a step. I'm not going to tell you which direction it's in, but like, that's a step. yeah. And so I got that kind of awkward laugh and that was fine with me. Cause to me, I was like, we acknowledged this elephant that we all see, but we're like, well, we're not going to talk about it. Okay. We're just not going to talk about it. And I was like, that's fine. That's how I treat my uncle's drinking problem. Like we all know it's there, but like, we're just not going to talk about it. And you know, I moved on.
Well, I mean, Arizona doesn't have Martin Luther King Day. Like,
because
that was insane to me.
Yeah. See, hello. What did I tell you? It was a collective. We don't talk about it. That's, as a state, they're very unified in ignoring things.
To be fair, were you in Phoenix or were you in Tucson?
I was in Phoenix. That was a primary spot for that.
Because I'm from Tucson, and I'll bet you, you get a little bit of a different audience in Tucson. So I'm going to just like say Tucson is okay.
Yeah. Yes. I also want to be clear just in this day and age. I mean, I am a comic, and so one of the things that we thrive off of is like mass generalizations for like a one-time experience. So I'm
you're not not everyone in Arizona is bad.
No.
Not all Arizonans,
right? Yeah. But that was an example that was very interesting to me because I predominantly perform up and down the coast of California, and I kind of can know what the what the response is. You know, it's a risk you take, and I think I just wouldn't want to personally be an audience member in a show that was so stringently political, especially because people use comedy as a way to escape what's going on. And so I try and consider that, like, maybe I'll mention things a few times, but like, it's hard right now. There's so many hard things going on.
Yeah.
And also if I don't feel like I can tackle it properly, then like, I'm not just going to bring it up just to like drop a bomb.
Mm. Yeah. That makes sense.
I mean, it's making me think of like the Dave Chappelle situation where he basically removed himself from stand up because he felt like people were laughing for the wrong reasons.
Mm.
Right, because he would talk about race, and then he felt like the laughter was racist,
right.
not understanding the joke. I feel like in the last few years, Jon Stewart's really removed himself because he feels like too burdened by the world to be funny. So what do you think the role of comedy should be in a time where there's so much political tension?
I mean, I think comedy should point to that. Like, comedy, I think, is one of the last bastions of true free speech. We have an ability to present really horrible things in a way that is more digestible to the common person or the everyday person. And it's a way that brings together actual like ranges of socioeconomic status, ranges of background, like you're all in the same room or you're all watching it on Netflix. And I'll say, I mean, I think Dave Chappelle's incredibly talented and I love when people bring him up. I was like, well, Dave Chappelle did this. Listen, Dave Chappelle has millions of dollars at his disposal, and rightfully so. But with that amount of generated wealth, he has more liberties in terms of what he can, like, try and cancel Dave Chappelle, and it'll make him even more rich and famous, the cancel culture for Dave Chappelle, which has happened several times, you know? Right. And so it's hard. It's like when you're lower and still starting out, yes, you can say anything, but it's like, but how much can you really say? Because people are always filming. I don't know. It's, people ask that a lot. I think I consider it with a, like water off a duck's back. I take it into consideration, but if I want to say it, I'm going to. And, but with that, I have to accept like what comes from owning what I'm going to say. Mm. And that's just me. I don't know. I, let me tell you, I've seen some cringy things on stage. I'm like, is this what we're saying right now? I'm like,
okay.
Yeah.
How I did snap back. Changed? Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, as a shout out to like Santa Barbara mayor, I did snap back at a comic who kept talking about in Santa Barbara and was making a joke about our Santa Barbara mayor and kept using he pronouns and referencing him as a man. And I was so frustrated. I said, our mayor is a woman. And the whole room laughed. And he's like, well, I didn't know. I said, then stop talking about Santa Barbara mayor like you do. Like, if you're going to make a very specific reference, just do a quick Google search. Like, that's all you have to do.
Yeah.
Two seconds. We all have these computers in our hands, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not a heckler, but I was just like, feminist rage came out. I was just like, our mayor is a woman and has been a woman for some time. Like, check yourself.
Also the audacity of like writing a joke that you literally know nothing about.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if you don't even know this person is, why are you making fun of them?
I was going to ask how comedy for you, or how you think it's changed since COVID hit.
Well, at my virtual shows, I limit the COVID jokes to like 5 jokes per show, not 5 jokes per comics. And like, we're all going through it.
Everybody gets one.
Yeah, you know, and make it your best.
Use
one.
Use it wisely.
How it's changed, I do a lot more virtual shows and that interaction is very different. I just had a live show for a competition the other day, and like, it's very strange going 3 months without being on a stage. I was like, why are the lights so bright? And I told like, you've been on stage before. I go, yes, I'm aware I've been on stage before many times over. I haven't been on stage in 3 months, and trust me, I was shocked that that was a real thought in my head. I was like, I have known the lights on stage are bright since I was in high school. And the first thing the director's like, he's like, everyone look at the lights. Yeah, they're bright. And we move past it. Mm. Okay. But it's changed because you have to, you're connecting with people differently. And I think there's a little laziness too. Like, people are like at home and you can tell sometimes if they're reading, and it's harder, but I mean, I'm not gonna complain.
Anymore. Yeah. I mean, I felt like when I was lecturing, sort of when we transitioned to Zoom, there was no feedback in the room, right? Mm. So, like, normally I'm like, oh, students are engaged. Oh, they're laughing at my dumb joke. Oh, this, right? Like, I can sort of read the room.
Yeah.
But when I felt like I was talking into the void, and then I found myself going into these, like, long existential monologues and, like, with no response. And then I'm like, maybe I'm just crazy. I hope you all are still there. Like, I don't know.
Gotcha.
if you feel that.
Yeah, no. We're all down that void, okay? I encourage everyone to turn on their video. We go back and forth on turning on audio just because if everyone doesn't have a great setup, it can be more distracting than it is helpful. But with the video, you can see people laughing, and I really encourage people to use the chat function. Like, if you like something, type it in. Like, we are loving that. And I still do some crowd work, and so do other comics I know. If we see your video on and you're laughing, we'll make some sort of comment. And it is funny. It's very weird. I mean, you're in people's homes. Like, people are having, I found out someone had their first date while coming to my comedy show, but they were cooking dinner with their person, and then they like carried us outside on, and so like when that happened, you know, they took their laptop, but it's very funny. And like, you'll comment, cause that's, it's a very personal experience. If you give yourself a pause to look like, ooh, you know, I can see your house or your kitchen or your bedroom, you know? So that's how comedy's changed. We're getting a lot more bedrooms.
Oh boy. I mean, school's changing too. I had students zooming in. They're like literally in their pajamas, curled up under their covers with just their faces peeking out. And I'm like, I don't need to see this.
You're like, that's not appropriate. Not appropriate.
So far, none of that. All the comics have been at least dressed from waist up and sitting, and everyone else as well.
I will say I did a Zoom workout where it was like a bunch of like young, beautiful women. And then there was a guy who was like, looking, and I was like, this is not okay. And then he disappeared, and I was like, oh, okay, this has changed. The world has changed.
He like just turned off his camera though, right? He didn't
he didn't leave. No, he just turned off his camera.
So we all know what's happening there.
Yeah. Yeah, so hopefully you don't get any of that, or if you do, you could call them out on it.
Ew.
I'm still creeped out. That was like months ago.
When was the first time you decided you were a comic or knew you were funny or?
Yeah, and how did you get there? That's what I was going to say. I was actually going to ask, when was the first time you realized you were funny?
In elementary
school. I'm still waiting for that day.
I used to tell dumb blonde jokes in middle school.
Yeah. Then you're funny. In elementary school. I mean, I loved telling jokes. I heard this joke on TV. I mean, it's not, there's nothing innovative about it, but as a child, I thought it was hysterical and I told it for years. And it was like, if gulls by the sea are called seagulls, what are gulls by the bay called?
Oh.
Bagels. And I,
oh, that's adorable.
Yeah. Oh, super cute. And I told it constantly and I would practice timing because that, no, that's not the best joke. But if a little kid delivers that with confidence and times it right, because it's all about the pause, I mean, that's delivery. So I've known since I was in elementary school. And I will say, you know, we become what we hear. And I heard it from friends, from teachers. Samantha's talking too much. Like, it's practicing myself. From partners, from my family, you know, wow, you're really funny. I think it really started laying on in high school. People were like, what movie is that from? Thinking I was quoting movies. And I was like, I'm just quoting myself.
You're like, I'm just the funny.
Yeah. And in college, I did improv for a while. And in grad school, I finally found a team that was competitive, that performed. And then I moved back to Santa Barbara. And the teams here, I think, are just trying to have a good time, which is great. But I do take it a bit more seriously, you know, and I want to be around people who will lift up, you know, you're as good as the worst player on your team or something like that. So I took the leap. I made a vision board. I'm one of those people. And
you manifested it.
Yeah, I did. And I the next day there was like a class, like a comedy writing class. And I thought, if I financially put money on this, I know that I'll do it and go and make it happen. And I did. And it's been just like nonstop ever since.
That's awesome. I had no idea there was a competitive improv world. Can you tell me more?
Yeah, the dark, seedy underbelly of yes. Well, you would go to competitions and compete with other improv teams.
And what are the, like, how did they judge you? Like, what were the categories?
Comics are so good at judging other people. Like, I don't think people give us enough credit.
Like, no, but like evaluating on a scale is what we mean.
Oh, okay. they're looking for like group work, how well you work together. Because a lot of people will think, oh my God, like the person who talked the most is the funniest person on that stage. But really, if your team is playing to your strengths, maybe like, for example, maybe I'm only saying 5 words or 5 sentences, which is, you can tell now that's not a lot. But if I'm doing that to make everyone around me look their best, that's a team working together. you know, and I always use that in interviews. I was like, I know how to play to people's strengths. Like, I know part of being a team isn't like making myself look the best. It's like, what makes you look the best? Because then they're doing what they can to make me look the best. So they're looking for that. Are you listening to each other? If you establish that there's a door or a table or something, you know, you've like mimed it out. Did anyone walk through it? Did anyone just go like, I forgot there was something there? Did they bump into it, this imaginary thing, and remind the audience like, oh shit, totally forgot that there's a
right. Oh, there's that door. Right, that yeah. door.
Isn't it weird that doors can open both ways? Like, that's strange. Doorknob keeps slipping.
I always, because we do an acting exercise where it's, like, all mimed. And it's amazing, like, when most, you know, when you don't rehearse it enough, like, things just fly away. You're like, oh yeah. I'm brushing my teeth. And then you, like, do something. And then, like, the tooth, I'm just like, where are these objects? They're just, like, flying all over the room.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so they're looking for that. And then just a story, you know, was there a beginning, middle, and end? Was there character development? Can they figure out where you are? What's your relationship? What's the controversy? Was the controversy solved? Those elements, which are much harder to develop naturally and very seamlessly. I mean, it's a skill. You guys know, like, you can be talented in anything. You can also not be talented and learn. But if you aren't practicing and flexing and exercising that skill, you know, it kind of becomes latent.
Yeah.
So that's what they're judging on. And maybe how much we bribe them before the show. I don't know. I mean, I would consider that.
What kind of bribes do comic judges like?
Listen, they're all out of work actors. They like Venmo. Okay. That's what they like.
Okay? Gotcha.
They're pretty simple.
I have a question about comedy and mental health, because there's this often stereotype that, like, comedians are often not the healthiest, sort of have the strongest mental health.
Yeah.
And there's, like, that old vaudeville joke about, like, a man who sees a doctor is like, I'm so sad. And the doctor's like, oh, you know what'll cheer you up? Go and see this show with Pagliacci the clown. And then, like, you find out that the man who went to the doctor because he's so sad was Pagliacci the clown. I'm butchering the joke. My time is awful, but like that's the premise of it. I know, but and you know, there is some, you know, some high profile sort of mental health mm-hmm. issues with comedians in general. So I'm just wondering if there is a connection, since you are skilled at both of those things, like what you see the relationship between the two.
Yeah, I say yes in general. I mean, mental health, it's so much more prevalent than anyone wants to see. Like that, I think that question could be answered in from any profession. With comics, though, I do feel that if I had to make a broad clinical diagnosis, is that the majority of us have a lot of struggle with anxiety, with depression. I was talking with Noah Coffer. I'm not only a fan of him as a person, but as a professional. He's been on my stage several times. He's so talented. I tell people, I was like, you better see him now, because like his tickets are going to go for hundreds of dollars later, you know? But we were talking about how, like, oh, everyone thinks we're so good at, like, meeting people, like, making that introduction. And we're just back here like, I'm so awkward. How do I say hello? But, and we laugh. We're like, thank God, like, we're magnetic and people come up to us. Because we both said, you know, we're not the best at, like, walking up to someone and, like, hi, human person. I'd like to meet you. And that sounds like it's a joke, but we're just like, you need to be able to come up to us. And so I don't think people see that a lot in comics, but anxiety and depression.
Well, I just think that you, like, a good comic, as you said, is like a good observer, is good at reading the room, is good at like understanding dynamics between people. But I think with that openness at like comes other, I mean, that's just my sort of non-professional take on it.
Yeah. So much comedy too is it's rooted in sadness. Right? Like when we joke about like dating situations, it's never because they're good.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and so there's so much, I think, comedy that is, it's funny because it's drawing a connection between shared sadness and like by sharing that sadness, there's an alleviation, and that's part of what, and like a lot of times we laugh because we're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so If you are good at identifying what's absurd or uncertain or risky about a situation, that also means that you can feel those things. Yeah. And if you're feeling all of those things to these sort of extremes, there seems to be some correlation there.
Yeah, I mean, it's an emotional experience going to a show, and it's an emotional release, and it's a community experience. It's like everyone is feeling this at the same time, or everyone has heard of this. And I mean, there are things that will come up that, you know, are non-lived experiences for everyone, but you can learn at a comedy show. And definitely we, you know, kind of mold sad situations and find the funny in them. But there's also jokes that are just out of like ridiculousness, like this, like I'm doing a podcast in my car. Like, that's a thing. I'll write about that.
Yeah, I just saw a FedEx truck drive by.
Yeah, it's you almost fell off my lap. You know, product placement for FedEx truck. So I think we talk about things that are sad, but we also talk about just the ridiculousness in life that often we all experience but don't want to like talk about. I think comedians, we just are bad at having filters. But also to that, I say grow with the times. And like, if you've said or done things in the past and you're set, own that and move on and move forward and move past that. I really appreciated when like Jon Stewart, for example, specifically called himself out. I think after being called out, but I mean, sometimes that's what it takes. And he talked about jokes he made about Monica Lewinsky. And he's like, I should not have done that. It was wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm part of the problem. And he's like, I'm not going to do that anymore.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, and 30 Rock just removed their episodes that had blackface in them.
Good.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they took them out.
Good.
I was just going to say, in terms of like sadness and like things that are wrong, I just put up a meme on my Instagram with Chris D'Elia, the scene from him in You, and I wrote, classic Hollywood typecasting. So like, you know... Let's bring a light to like the awfulness and and also it's to me that was like a bigger thing, like Hollywood does typecast, but like what do they know that we don't know? That's right.
Makes you look at the characters differently. Yeah. All right, well, I think it's time for the provocation, so
oh my god, I love this.
We're real lo-fi over here. No special effects, no sound effects.
It's great. So what I understood the provocation was a call to action so that there could also be a tangible thing at the end of it. So not just a thought, but a tangible thing. So what I want to call to action all the people who are listening is to really ask yourself what is something you love and what is missing from that? And what can you do to create a space for that?
Ooh.
Okay.
Yeah. So write that list down, and that will include who you need to talk to, who you need to speak to, and do something about it. You know, I am touted as having the tiniest stage in Santa Barbara, but my room is packed. You know, my virtual shows continue to draw people. And it's because I looked around and I didn't see myself reflected. And I thought, I want to make that happen now. I don't want to wait. I want to make that space. So look and see, are you being represented in the things that you love, in books that you're reading, in movies you're watching, shows they're watching on TV, things that you're streaming on TikTok, on Instagram? Like, it doesn't.
I am not represented on TikTok.
Yeah.
That's okay. Okay. Well, just an example, you know, if you're not represented, you have the ability to do something about it, and just asking yourself, what is it that you want to do? What can you do? And who can be part of your team? Honestly, that is my call to action. That's my provocation. Find what's missing. Find how you can do something about it. And then find who wants to help you do something about it. Because I guarantee you, number three, there are so many people who are just waiting to be asked.
Okay. I feel secretly pressured to get on TikTok now.
Because we do the provocation. Hattie and I at least do it, and then we talk about having done it. So,
well, I can't wait
at least do it.
To hear, I'm going to check in. I want to know the follow-up.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we'll make a difference somehow. And Hattie might make a TikTok dance video.
Oh, God.
Do it.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank
this was
you
really
so
fun.
Much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Have a safe drive back to Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Oh, I will.
Okay. Thanks, Samantha, for sitting in your car with us. I don't think I've ever laughed that much so early in the morning.
Before our coffee.
Yeah, that's why Hattie and I had different voices. You're like, who is interviewing Samantha this week? It's not those normal women.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us once again.
If anything came up in the show this week that you want to know more about, be sure to check out the show notes.
And do the provocation. We'll be doing it. So think about what you love, what is missing from that space, and then do something about it. And don't forget to tag us. Hashtag ArtIfPodcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast as much as we are. Next week, our gallery theme is art and improvisation. And I'm not going to prepare. Just kidding.
That's not what that means.
And then we interview jazz musician Bill Perry. Be sure to rate and review us wherever you're listening. Bye.
Oh, bye. Oh, I was moving on.
Art If Podcast is produced by
Hattie Cry
and Yasi Jahanmir.
Our theme music was composed by Muhammad Abdul Salam.
Follow us at Art If Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to stay up to date on upcoming episodes and to join our vibrant community of artists.